Welcome to the Right on Point podcast with your host Wayne Rohde, a candid discussion of legal rights and issues surrounding the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, also known as the Vaccine Court, the PrEP Act, the Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program, and legalities of possible mandates of a potential COVID vaccine.
Welcome to the Right on Point podcast. You can follow this discussion and previous discussions from our website, rightonpoint.online. I'm your host, Wayne Rohde. We're broadcasting from the studios in the Great White North of Minnesota. Programming note to our listeners, I've just released up on the website my interview with Gerald Posner, New York Times bestselling author, about his new book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. We had a real good discussion of the Sackler family, Purdue Pharmaceuticals, and the opioid epidemic. Lots to discuss. Make sure you subscribe to the program wherever you get your podcasts, wherever it's iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, Buzzsprouts, iTunes. We're all over the place. And if you'd like to donate to the nonprofit that operates the show, please do. I am extremely excited and real pleased to put this program together, this one today. I've got Minnesota State Senator Scott Jensen, who I've known for a few years. We've worked together up at the Capitol. And from the land where it's a little bit warmer, out there on the West Coast, than it is here in Minnesota, Dr. Henry Ely. Dr. Ely authored a paper, COVID-19 Data Collection, a Historical Retrospective, published in October of this year. I'll put a link up to the paper on our website for our listeners. Dr. Ely is the founder and executive community director for the Energetic Health Institute, and he holds a doctorate in naturopathic medicine from SCNM and a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from UCLA, and is board certified in holistic nutrition by the NAMP. Dr. Scott Jensen, state senator from Minnesota, is from the Twin Cities area in Chaska, a nice little quaint small town. I love it down there. Practicing doctor and soon to be retired senator. It's too bad we're going to miss him up there at the Capitol. He attended Lutheran Northwestern Theological Seminary from 1977 to 1978, and then the University of Minnesota, graduating with a Bachelor of Arts in physiology in 1978, and a doctor of medicine in 1981. And he was a Bush Fellow of Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Minnesota in 1999. Please welcome Dr. Jensen and Dr. Ely. Welcome to the program, guys.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, as well. Thank you, Wayne, for having me on. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Okay. I saw this interview. Dr. Ely, you had an interview with Dr. James Weiler, and it was about this paper, and it caught my attention. But at the same time, I've been wanting to get Dr. Jensen on, and we were going to try to maybe set up an interview at the end of October, but then things started changing, so I said, I'm going to wait. And this idea is starting to merge together in this, what I call CDC guidance and the way the state health departments and hospital administrators are dealing with COVID-related deaths and the reporting issues. Now, that's a big concern to everybody because a lot of people are saying, well, the deaths from COVID is not over 300,000 or in certain states, whatever the number is. Dr. Jensen, you've been speaking about this for some time. What is going on here with the reporting? Is there a big problem? What are we doing here?
That's a great question, Wayne. And if I could, I'd love to unpack it just a little bit. I remember very vividly sitting at this very desk on April 3rd. It was a Friday. And I was running behind and I had hundreds of emails and I was clicking through them. And I was just about to delete this one from the Minnesota Department of Health when I saw the letters VS, which usually means vital statistics. And I stopped and I thought, well, I better look at it because I've been a physician for 35 years and many of my patients have grown a little older with me. And so I do death certificates with some frequency. And I clicked on the email, opened it up, and read the one-page document from the Department of Health. And toward the bottom of the page, I'm reading along and my heart sank because I said, well, that's not right. I've never done that before. And in the last paragraph or so, I was being encouraged as the reader that it was okay for me to go ahead and diagnose COVID-19 as a cause of death, even if I wasn't sure, even if I hadn't done a test. And it went on to say that if it was probable or more likely than not, there was more language to that direction. And Then it went on to say that if COVID-19 was felt to be a contributing condition, it could be put as a cause of death. But if it was asthma that was a contributing condition, then we should continue to treat asthma as we would in a normal situation where it would be put in part two in the box called contributing conditions. And it was very clear to me very quickly that we were basically being coached to use COVID-19 as a cause of death in situations where we wouldn't use emphysema, we wouldn't use asthma, we wouldn't use influenza. And I thought, well, what the heck is up with this? So a few days later, after I'd had a chance to digest the information, and I also followed the links on the Minnesota Department of Health page, and I went to the CDC link and read a 7-page document there. And in that 7-page document, the CDC shared some various scenarios as to where COVID-19 would be an appropriate cause of death. And in one of the situations, it was a patient who'd suffered a severe stroke and over a 2-year period of time had, if you will, dwindled and her health had gone downhill. But in the end, the scenario that the CDC put together was this patient was exposed to a family member who later was diagnosed with COVID. And because of that, when the patient succumbed after a long battle with this stroke and the weakness and the debility that came with it, the patient finally died. And rather than have CVA or stroke as the cause of death, I was advised that this would be a COVID-19 death. Never had a test done. And I thought, well, that's not what you do, because the CDC says that you should identify the initiating event that triggered the train or sequence of events that led to a patient's demise. That's the way death certificates have always been done. And I was troubled by that. So then I went to the CDC's handbook, physician handbook, as to how to complete death certificates. And again, my beliefs were reaffirmed. So then I was on a radio or news program, TV program, a few days later out of Fargo, Moorhead, with a fellow named Chris Berg. And we were talking about it. I made a comment regarding this. And he said, well, what do you mean, Doc? You mean you're actually being coached as to how to do death certificates after 35 years in medicine? And I said, yeah. Well, 2 days later, Laura Ingram on Fox News asked me if I'd come on. And so we talked about it there. And one of the questions that came up was, well, why? What's the motivation for this? Why are we seeing this? And I said, I don't know. To me, it just seemed silly. So I hypothesized, I said, you know, it's possible that dollars could be driving this. Fear mongering could be driving it. And I went on to share later that if you diagnose COVID-19 on a hospital discharge, you get more money if it's a Medicare patient than if you don't. So if you have a garden variety pneumonia in a Medicare patient in the hospital, you get a bundled payment of around $5,000. But if it said more than just pneumococcal pneumonia or pneumonia, and if instead it said COVID-19 pneumonia, then you don't get $5,000, you get $13,000. And if during the hospitalization a ventilator is used for that patient, then you bump up to $39,000. Well, this, if you will, initiated a spiraling cascade that ultimately led to me being criticized by my colleagues, by fellow senators, by bureaucrats, by epidemiologists. I felt like I was the most targeted physician in Minnesota. And then in June, I found out from the Board of Medical Practice that my license was being investigated because I'd been accused of spreading misinformation and providing reckless advice because I had dared to do what Dr. Fauci had done when I compared influenza and some of its qualities to COVID-19. Mm-hmm. So I submitted a 8-page, 5,000-word response and 70 pages of attachments. And after a month, the Board of Medical Practice said they were dismissing the allegations. Then a month later, I was notified by the board again that I was being investigated because now I was a danger to public health because I had compared 2009 swine flu epidemic with the COVID-19. And it took 3 months, and then that was dismissed. And since then, I've received some nasty voice messages from people who are telling me that they're going to go after me again. So I really learned what it's like to have a target on my back. Mm-hmm. And it was all over. It was all about this straightforward thing that a death certificate should be an instrument that is precise. It's sort of the last service I provide a patient. I need to do some cogitation to make certain that, in fact, I was identifying the initiating cause and then following a sequence of events that led to a patient's demise. And so now here we sit today. I think what we're seeing around the country is that there really has been a fair amount of data corruption. We see Colorado just recently, a coroner came out and said, this is silly. We have 40% of the deaths in our county that are being attributed to COVID were gunshot wounds. We've seen New York State bump up its COVID-19 death count by almost 50% early on in the pandemic because they had a delta in terms of how many people had died from the baseline of what they might have expected. Right. And so they said, well, this difference must be COVID-19. We saw Kentucky remove some people from its death count. We saw Pennsylvania step in. We saw Florida step in. We have seen a mumble jumble of corrupted data around the country. And then what really makes it problematic is we're seeing that there's a utilization of this data to try to get a bigger piece of the pie from the federal government when it comes to, if you will, the CARES Act and other initiatives the government has put in place. So we are seeing this thing come full circle. We saw the initial data corruption lead to, if you will, a certain vigorous attempt to say, well, we should be getting more money because we've had more cases or we've had more index of severity when it comes to our COVID-19. And the CARES Act lays all that out. So that's pretty much the short story.
Well, if anybody wants to listen to what he was talking about with the CARES Act, out on YouTube, there's a tremendous, it's a great video interview of you and Representative Mary Franzen that you did. And it just lays out, Mary grabbed a whole bunch of data from the Department of Health from Minnesota, and you guys examined it, and you show that there's a potential, maybe what, for 40% of the deaths are really not because of COVID. We don't know till you examine it completely. But then also the money that the hospitals get, you know, if they reach, what is it, the COVID impact fund or whatever they want to call it, that they get, well, if they reach like 100 cases, then they get reimbursed by this, the Federal CARES Act for $75,000, $76,000, $77,000 per case. It's exactly incredible.
Basically what happened was the CARES Act distributions were done on different formulas. The first distributions were based on previous formulas used in 2019 and 2018, but the high impact distribution was based on if you as a hospital could reach 161 admissions with COVID-19, then you received, in addition to what you've already been paid, $77,000 per admission, which for many of these hospitals would be $25, $30 million. Then there was another high impact distribution a little later on, whereby if you could reach 100 COVID-19 admissions, then you would receive $50,000 per admission. And the interview that Representative Franzen and I had, what it displayed was we went through the first 2,800 death certificates in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And what we found was in only 2,000 of those was the underlying cause of death COVID. The other 800 had COVID-19 scattered about the death certificate. But it's really important for people to understand that when we tabulate data in this country, when we say that 3 million Americans die every year and 650,000 of them die from cardiovascular disorders, where we get that data is the underlying cause of death on a death certificate. It's not the immediate cause of death. The immediate cause of death might be a superimposed pneumonia. It might have been kidney failure, but it's the underlying cause of death. It's the thing that triggered it. It might be the heart attack. It might be coronary artery disease. It might be hardening of the arteries. It might be congestive heart failure, but all of those would be cardiovascular problems, and that's what you would see. And so when we say that we have 650,000 deaths every year in America from cardiovascular disease, we're basically saying that 650,000 death certificates have cardiovascular diagnoses on that line that says this is the underlying cause of death. That's what was going wrong with the Minnesota data. We had 2,000 of those, but 2,800 were being listed, which meant that 800 over 2,000 was 40%. So we had 40% inflation. And that's what we talked about the other day. And to me, what this means more than anything is we have got to have states audited for what they're doing, because I don't think we're comparing apples to apples. The fact of the matter is, I've talked to hospital administrators, and I know there are some hospitals that are willing to make the diagnosis of COVID-19 without a positive test. If they know that they have epidemiologic evidence because there's community transmission in the area, and if they have subjective evidence, which would mean cough, shortness of breath, or fever, if you have two of three, you don't have to have a positive test. You can take epidemiology, you can take subjective symptoms. That's enough to establish the diagnosis. Now, in my mind, if you haven't done a test, if you don't have a positive test, I don't think you really have COVID-19 established.
Well, let's talk about the test. PCR tests, there's been a lot of discussions. Dr. Ely, chime in if you want to on this. Dr. Jensen, this PCR test, what I'm reading is that it's not reliable. It wasn't really designed when you start, well, I guess when you're processing the test and cycling it up 35, 38, 40 times, whatever, I guess you pick up every positive thing to dust mites to whatever, whereas is that if it was done the way it was designed, you'd be much less cycling. Is that correct? And therefore, that's why we're getting particles that really are not, you know, vibrant.
It's sort of like this. If you came in, Wayne, and I was going to test your hearing in the office, and I knew that 20 decibels should be the volume that I need to give you in order for you to hear something. Right. And I give you a sound at 20 decibels and you don't hear it. So I turn the dial up a little bit and I go to 30 and I go to 40 and I go to 50. Every time I do it, I'm increasing the decibels exponentially. If I get to 120 decibels, that's a noise that's equivalent to you standing on the runway when a 747 takes off right by you. But if I keep cranking it up, unless you're totally stone deaf, I will be able to get to a point where I get a positive test where you say, ah, Dr. Jensen, I hear the noise. That's what we're doing with the PCR test. We're simply saying we're not going to stop at 25 cycles, which is where pretty much we can retrieve actual viral growth in a culture plate at 25. Once we go above 25, we might be able to pick up a snippet of RNA material, but it won't be representative of actual infectious disease. It could be from some previous disease where you've got some snippets of RNA lying around in the lungs, in the sinuses, wherever. And it's even been argued that you might even pick up that snippet from previous coronavirus infections. But once you run it to 30 and 35 and 40, you are simply saying, we don't care about specificity. All we care about is sensitivity. We want to make sure that we're picking up 100%. And when you do that, you sacrifice precision on the other side of it, which is if we have specificity that drops down to 83%, we'll live with that. Well, what happened in some places was 1,000 people were told that they had a positive COVID-19 test. But the fact of the matter is, if they hadn't gone to 38 to 44 cycles, if they would have stopped at 26 or even 30, not 1,000 people would have had COVID-19. Only 150 of them would have had it. 850 of those people that had been told they had COVID-19 would have been told, you have a negative test. So we know that the PCR testing is flawed. The creator of the process, a guy named Kerry Mullis, said this should not be used to diagnose viral disease. The writing on the wall is absolutely clear. We have a case demic. We have a case fatality rate that's been slowly dropping since March and April, but it's not having the impact that it should have.
Well, that can I piggyback on that, Wayne? And thank you for bringing that up, Dr. Jensen. So, couple things. Number one, we know that the CDC has published very clearly that the PCR test can show positive, even though a person isn't contagious, up to 12 weeks following the conclusion of a contagious period. So that's number one. A person can be, in their sample that's collected, be demonstrating viral fragments of SARS-CoV-2 virus for up to 12 weeks, even though they're no longer contagious. So what a PCR test is going to do, it can give you an accurate reading on how many people have maybe ever had this, right? But it cannot tell you who is sick today, which is supposed to be the primary investigation at this point. So the way we've always done this, and Dr. Jensen, correct me if I'm wrong, But the way we've always done this and that it's been taught globally has been symptoms number one. I want to reiterate that today we have zero confirmed cases globally of asymptomatic transmission. We have a few anecdotal cases of asymptomatic transmission, but we do not have a definitive confirmation of even one asymptomatic case globally. Number two is going to be viral load. We want to make sure we can see how much of the virus is present in the bloodstream, because if it's present in high amounts and you have symptoms, it's a pretty good reason. Mm-hmm. It's pretty good reason that you're going to be contagious. But what we then do is we have a third confirmatory test, and that's going to be antibody testing. And that's going to be IgM is going to show positive if you're in the early stages of your immune system engaging natural adaptive immunity and figuring this out. IgG is going to be showing if your immune system has really figured this out. What has been baffling me this entire time is that the CDC sits on a very important group of studies that we go through just about every decade called the NHANES studies. And the NHANES studies show conclusively that Americans are deficient in key nutrients to engage the natural adaptive immunity, right? Vitamin D, vitamin A, zinc, and vitamin C. We are deficient in that. So it stands to reason to me, and this is something I've talked with a bunch of anybody who will listen on, basically, is I get the mask guidance. I get the social distancing guidance. I'm not going to argue against that at this point. It's too ingrained. But I am going to ask a question. Why are we not giving additional nutritional guidance to all Americans, particularly our Americans that we know who are at high risk? The high risk group we identified following the data that we found in Italy, the data that came out of South Korea, I want everybody to know, we can never validate the data that's come out of China. China does not share their data internationally, so you don't know what you're getting with that. But we validated the South Korea data early on. We validated the Italian data from the Italian Ministry of Health early on, and it was very clear. And CNBC reported on this, Forbes reported on this, Bloomberg reported on this. Our high-risk group in March was over 60 with pre-existing health conditions like diabetes, like respiratory illnesses, and so forth. So what came up for us was, if we know that, why are we doing a one-size-fits-all approach to public health policy? Why aren't we protecting our most at risk and making sure everyone has nutritional guidelines based upon the NHANES studies, which show deficiencies, to make sure we're shoring up all of these wonderful nutrients that the immune system needs. Mm-hmm. And then here's a thought. Why are we reporting cases and fatalities? Why are we not reporting recoveries? And why are we not reporting fatalities based upon age demographic? Because it paints such a different picture. When I look at probability of recovery, and I just updated all my records last week, if you're under 65, the probability of recovery from this infection is 99.602%. This is per CDC data, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So now, correct me, Dr. Jensen, if I'm wrong. To me, that doesn't feel like an emergency situation. What's your opinion on that for people under 65?
Well, you made a lot of excellent comments there, Dr. Elian. So I'll just unpack it a little bit, starting at the back end. What do I think of that? I think you're absolutely right. And I think some people have said, well, why are you making such a big deal about it? Well, this is a big deal because these data pieces are being used to justify school closures, lockdowns, and a variety of other things. But if I could actually go back to a different point you made, Dr. Ely, you're absolutely right. This could go down in history as one of the greatest public health failures. There has been virtually no push to do, you said you had your four things. You had vitamin A, C, D, and zinc. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. And then the other two things I would say is, if you have a BMI of greater than 28, mm-hmm. then lose 5 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And get off the couch at least 3 times a week and go walk for 15 minutes mm-hmm. as vigorously as you can. If we'd had our departments of health and the CDC saying, if you would do this and lay it out, instead of having all these posters everywhere you go about, you know, masks, if we would have said vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, take a walk, lose 5 pounds. If we would have started a nationwide Who knows how many people's lives would have been spared? We've not done that. And in fact, we've doubled down where when people do get sick, we've said, listen, now that you got COVID-19, mm-hmm. it's a binary choice. Either get better on your own or wait till you get sick enough to go in the hospital. And once you go in the hospital, what are you told? Oh, option one is no longer available to you because you're in a hospital. Oh, option two is not available. Option three is not available. Mm-hmm. So we're going to do this, this, and this. And all of a sudden, you end up sitting there looking at a physician who's saying, we might have to paralyze you, put a tube down your throat, and put you on a ventilator. This heartless willingness on a part of our CDC and departments of health to not help people do something, anything at the front end of this. Multi-drug outpatient treatment programs are used frequently. And we're talking about drugs that have a safety profile that's been far more established than many very common drugs we use today. I'm not going to die on the hill about hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, but I think both medications have substantial availability and likelihood to help. Budesonide as a steroid makes all the sense in the world when we learn over and over again that what we're seeing is an immune response gone crazy. And we have to deal with that. People are dying not generally because the replication and the quantity of circulating virus has overwhelmed the organism. They're dying because their own immune system has gone crazy and is forming micro blood clots, isn't allowing oxygenation to occur, is causing multi-system damage, and we're not doing anything. So when we're done with this and we get on the other side of this, there are some people that should never have a role again in responding to a pandemic like this. They shall have lost their credibility.
Agreed. You know, I was talking with one of my MD colleagues, Dr. Jensen, and he informed me on something that I don't know what's going around the country, but it's a little key little thing that we're hearing happening bits and pieces with great results. And it's just because people started thinking. They said, look, you're tying my hands behind my back. I want to help people. That's what you love about a doctor. That's what you love about a nurse, is I'm going to run into that burning building if I got to run into it, right? That's what you love about us. But you can't tie my hands behind my back before I run into that building. I need those. So what he said is they stopped for a second. They said, let's pull back on the ventilators because we're seeing autopsy reports that are showing lung tissue that is highly saturated with the blood and the microclots that Dr. Jensen just alluded to the point where the lung tissue will be 7 to 8 pounds heavier than it would be in a normal, healthy person. People are literally choking on the oxygen that they're trying to shove down their throats. So they said, wait a minute, let's look at this a little differently. What if we took patients that were in the hospital, especially in ICU, and we had them lay on one side for an hour and then turn them over and lay on the other side for an hour? So that way we make sure there's at least one lobe of the lungs that is basically clear. Gravity can now work to keep some of this accumulated blood down on one side. And if we just keep rotating that person every hour, we get better outcomes. This is without ivermectin. This is without hydroxychloroquine, which I got to tell you, I would have loved to have seen, because we're seeing globally, the peer-reviewed research is outstanding on these things, right? So you say, well, what if we would have given, imagine this situation, Wayne. You just get admitted into the hospital, right? How awesome would it have been if you get admitted in the hospital, we say, here's the protocol. We have to isolate you. We are going to allow your family in because we need family advocates there. But family, we need you to sign a waiver and we need you to agree to quarantine after you're done out of here. Which family wouldn't have signed that, right? So now we have a family advocate right there next to the bed. We understand, we've read the health studies on the NHANES. We understand that there's likely some deficiencies. We can check vitamin D in hours, right, to see if there's a deficiency. But we're going to assume that you're vitamin D deficient. We're going to assume you're vitamin A deficient. We're going to assume that you're zinc deficient. We're going to start making sure that's a part of this treatment. And then here's what we're going to go, Mr. or Mrs. Patient. We are going to give you and your family the option. Do you want to get into the ivermectin? Do you want to get into hydroxychloroquine? Do you want to go fully naturally? And you choose, because that's who gets to choose under the patient bill of rights. You choose. And then guess what we just collected? We collected data. We now get to see which treatment options are showing the greatest efficacy so that we can update these numbers around the country every single month and give patients a more informed choice. How crazy would that be? I mean, Dr. Jensen, am I crazy? I mean, I know I'm a naturopath, so I'm already off the reservation, but
you're not crazy. And the fact of the matter is, I just want to thank you for your passion for mm-hmm. data, because you're right. You're saying there's data to be had, and it doesn't have to be terribly expensive, complicated to do. And in fact, if I could just use that as a brief segue into the paper that you and some of your colleagues wrote, I think it came out on October 12, 2020, COVID-19 data collection, comorbidity and federal law, an historical retrospective. I saw that. I don't know where, someone sent it to me. And it's a lengthy document. It's 23 pages, I think, but maybe 20, whatever. But the bottom line is, you've put in front of all of us all that we need to understand why we have the problem we have. And I would really encourage people to go to your document and go to page 4 and start reading the timeline, where at the bottom of page 4, you reference the COVID-19 alert number 2. And you mention things that have never been raised. I've never seen them anywhere but this paper, where you reference the fact that generally, when there is going to be changes in regards to how things are done, there needs to be a 60-day notice where people can have comment and we can have discussion. These things were ignored. And so if you go on to page 5, you'll see where the CDC was making one decision after another after mm-hmm. another. And it led to the corruption of the death certificate data that we've generally been able to rely on for years and decades. But we couldn't now, not anymore. And you laid out exactly what happened. You commented on April 14th in regards to Dr. John Ioannidis' comments regarding the seroprevalence research. And you did a marvelous job of just giving anybody that has an appetite for understanding what happened here. It's all right there. I've already mentioned that I was under the gun with the Board of Medical Practice investigating my license. But when I got this document, I made a copy and added this document to my file, to my Board of Medical Practice file right away, even though I'd already been, if you will, exonerated to be on the top of my file. Mm-hmm. And so again, I would just say it was an Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge. If you just Google that, it'll come up perhaps later on. Dr. Ely, you could provide a reference that people could find it easily, but mm-hmm. You deserve an incredible load of thanks for putting that together, because this puts it out there as plain as day.
I am humbled and overwhelmed with appreciation for those comments, Dr. Jensen. I will tell you that my team has been is made up of a bunch of just good Americans, nonpartisan. We're neutral. We do our best to be knowledgeable on this subject, make sure our research is right, make sure that the paper you're referencing is a culmination of about 10,000 plus hours of research collectively. It was reviewed by 9 attorneys. It was reviewed by a judge for accuracy. It went through an extensive 6-week peer review process with IPAC. And I just want everyone listening to this to know that a lot of it came from you. A lot of it came from us watching you and having the courage to speak out about this early on in April and the issues that you were having with what they were asking doctors and medical examiners and coroners to do in terms of completely changing how death certificates are reported, but only for COVID-19. And, you know, for us, we look at that and we go, here's not only a senator, but a licensed physician. We know you're going to take a bunch of arrows for doing that, and still you do it. And then it starts. So our question, when we were going through this, and believe me, our jaws dropped a number of times through this process, when there were some times where people were starting to get cold feet. Should we even publish this? What's going to be the brushback on this and everything? And then we, as a team, got together and we had a collection of folks like yourself and like Dr. Ioannidis in Stanford, Dr. Reich out of Yale, and just saying, look, if these brave people are willing to speak out, who are we, knowing what we know, to not share this? So it's really an honor to have you hold what mm-hmm. we've done in high esteem. We really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And Wayne, I do need to step away, but I wanted to just tell you one other thing. When you invited me to do this podcast and you said that you wanted to have me have a dialogue with Dr. Henry Ely, my ears perked up because I thought, Henry Ely, he's the guy who masterminded that compendium of historical information on what the hell's happened in this whole damn thing. And so I was tickled pink. So again, I do have another meeting I have to get to, but I so appreciate the work both of you are doing. And I'd love to circle back sometime again and have a conversation. Henry, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Dr. Jensen, thank you very much for being here. We're going to take a short break and then we're going to come back and Dr. Ely and I are going to get into his document plus his, some of the other work and answer the one question I want him to answer is, did the CDC violate federal law? So we'll be back in just a couple minutes.